first the charged and often treacherous divide between church and state. Georgetown professor Jacques Berlinerblau says, we still don't know how to talk intelligently about religion in public life, and that's why he wrote a book called How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom.
I want to preface the remarks by saying secular is probably the most misunderstood word in the American political lexicon. The way I prefer to define it is to look at it as a political philosophy that is skeptical, maybe even paranoid, about any form of entanglement between government and religion.
It's been redefined by a lot of people as a synonym for atheist, though, hasn't it?
The term secularism was coined by George Jacob Holyoake in 1851. And what's really interesting is that Holyoake was adamant that it was not atheism. So I guess the confusion might have existed in the middle of the 19th century. In any case, we've been trying to pry the two terms apart for a good long time.
One of the problems I think people face with it is that they don't see that you can be both religious and secular at the same time. But you don't see a problem with that, do you?
Well, absolutely not. Atheism is a metaphysical, or better yet, anti-metaphysical proposition or discourse or science, if you will. Secularism is a political idea. It's a political conception which is deeply concerned, even skeptical, even paranoid, about any and all types of entanglement between government and religion.
But what it implies is that you can be both religious and secular at the same time, which a lot of people would take as abomination.
Well, the history of secularism is about religious people. The term itself, if we want to trace its modern genealogy, emerges from the thought, brace yourself, of Martin Luther, the great 16th century Protestant reformer. He's the first person to think very, very seriously about the possibilities of secular government. From there, John Locke, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison. These are all religious, in particular Protestant individuals. So we have to understand that secular is born of the Christian political philosophical spirit. It's not born of the atheist spirit.
So secularism came into being as a way of saving religion?
Well, it's kind of a herky-jerky development. Secularism as we know it probably comes into clearest focus at the end of the 17th and 18th century, when people are just looking at the debris and the destruction of the wars of religion of the 17th century. And the question arises, how can we all live together if we happen to believe different things about the nature of the divine? And this is where secularism really has a valuable role to play.
So the secular is designed to save freedom of religion.
Absolutely. It's a very odd situation that secularism works so well that people actually forget what it does. And I think in the current frame of American history, we're seeing that right now. We're forgetting why in the mid-20th century, the United States Supreme Court decided to really pull church and state apart rather aggressively. We refer to this as legal separationism. But it worked swimmingly, I think, for a good 50, 60 years. And then all of a sudden, the question arises, well, why can't we have a little more religion in public life? Why can't a president say prayers? Why can't we invoke God's name in school? Why can't kids in a cafeteria at a public school pray? So, secularism sometimes works so well that we forget. Of course, if you look at the Soviet case, sometimes it works so horrifically that we try not to be secular.
Well, I wonder if you'd be willing to, from your perspective, answer a couple of those questions you just asked. Why can't a president say a prayer at a breakfast? Why can't a prayer be said in school?
Yeah. James Madison confronted this issue throughout his presidency, and his conclusion was you've got to let the unessential differences drop. If not, we're never going to get anything done. The reason I invoke Madison's name is my view is some of these things are really, really minor, and secularists, be they believers or non-believers, just have to let them go. There's something I called creche activism. Whenever a nativity scene pops up in front of a post office or a federal building, a lot of secularists go into a sort of emotional overdrive. I think a lot of those examples are really innocuous. They might be annoying, but perhaps secularism has bigger fish to fry. Then there are cases which I do feel threaten the core secular principle, at least in the United States, of disestablishment. And this is where we need to get worried. When politicians start speaking about the United States as a Christian nation, I think our fight or flight bells are rung. When a school has only one type of denominational representative come year after year to give invocations and blessings at graduation or at commencement exercises, whatever they might be, then I think we have to be very, very cautious. The danger is religious establishment.
And that's why you have that odd bunch, Martin Luther and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, along with Roger Williams.
Yeah, the horror of establishment, and what I learned writing the book, is the horror of Catholicism. Isn't it funny how we forget about the American tradition of anti-Catholicism? And the 19th century, the second half of the 19th century, is a real high watermark for this type of irrational dislike of Catholics. And I regret to say, secularism has a lot of blood on its hands. They're secular governments that go catastrophically wrong. Case in point is the Soviet Union, which is in fact a form of secularism. So I don't want to fetishize secularism. I don't want to say it always works under all circumstances. I think when it does work, it's the least awful alternative for managing a religiously pluralistic society such as our own.
So the question is, what should secularists do? Because it seems as though they're fighting in the interest of everyone.
Right. Secularists have to first have reasonable expectations. I never thought I would come to this conclusion when I started this project about 10 years ago. They have to understand that the idea of absolute separation of church and state, which is an idea that I personally think is kind of swell, but it ain't gonna happen, and it's never happened, and in those places where they tried to make it happen, nobody would ever want to live there. So another thing I try to do in the book is to track the trajectory of this phrase, separation of church and state, which we secularists tend to assume is in the Constitution. But here's the rub. It's not in the Constitution. And a practical secular politics is going to have to confront that fact and move forward.
There's a lovely slogan you put forward at one point, secularism, freedom from religions you really don't like.
There it is, freedom from religions you really don't like. It's like the don't tread on me of the secular movement. And at its core, that's the takeaway from secularism. That's what it offers people. It says, you, Baptist citizen of Utah, you won't have to live under a Mormon establishment. And you, my Catholic friend living in Greenwich Village, will not have to live under a Jewish establishment. And I think most Americans are really on board with that conception of secularism. And I feel this is a good secularish way of living one's life, to love God or not love God. I apply the same logic to non-believers. But without losing your marbles over the existence or non-existence of God.
So it's not so important that you be wrong or that I be right.
You've actually read me very, very well. On metaphysical issues, I prefer living in a world where it's totally cool with me if you happen to believe that Jesus Christ walked on. I have no problem with that, as long as you don't have a problem with my strange congeries of metaphysical and anti-metaphysical beliefs. In fact, I don't even think we should discuss them. I think it's dangerous to bring them into the public domain. And I know I'm treading on some very unpopular ground here. I just think it's better we discuss those things in our theological seminaries or our new atheist cafes, and ideally in a college classroom, which is ostensibly where I live. Now, I'm Jewish, so Jews really understood the logic of it's better this way, not constantly discussing Jews in public, not getting into the ins and outs of halakha or rabbinic legislation. And Jews liked it sort of under the radar that way. And I often wonder if these insoluble, and by insoluble, I mean we'll never solve these things, if these metaphysical discussions, which are very good discussions, I would like to add, I would never want to foreclose the discussions altogether. I wonder what good it is to have these discussions in kind of public political space where you have politicians talking, Jesus did this, Jesus did that, or we detest this tenet of that faith. I'm very, very nervous about those sorts of conversations.
That's Jacques Berlinerblau. He runs the Program for Jewish Civilization at Georgetown University. His book, is called How to Be Secular.